Good morning.
With the court's permission, Alan Greer, representing the petitioner Carlos Lumier. Your Honors, the central issue in this appeal is whether the OCC was substantially justified in seeking to bar Mr. Lumier for life from ever representing a insured financial institution and seeking to fine him $250,000 because he did not do in a 2.5 month investigation what the OCC could not do in 2.5 years when it had 15 to 19 bank examiners in Hamilton Bank pouring through its records. It had the access to 10 experts it used and a team of lawyers conducting 20 depositions, and it could not determine what it wanted Mr. Lumier to determine. Mr. Lumier was part of a audit investigation team put together by the firm of Greenberg Traurig at the request of Hamilton Bank's audit committee when Deloitte and Touche said they needed an outside group of attorneys to do a historic investigation of the conduct of the bank's management. In this setting, Mr. Lumier found and reported that they were unable to make a factual determination that the bank's office, three principal officers, had lied or misstated facts to the accountants, the audit committee, and the OCC. At the same time, the OCC could not do that either. The OCC issued its report of examination for the year 2001 after Mr. Lumier's audit investigation report was made. In the bank examination report, the OCC said that the principal malefactor here, Mr. Masferrer, had an important role to play in the bank, and that the worst the OCC could say was they did not strongly support bank's management.
I guess the theory the OCC has is that there was a violation of the conflicts policy, so a breach of the fiduciary duty, and that it was reckless for your client not to know that, and then the case ultimately, at this point, probably turns on the effects prong and whether that had some effect. And that gets very hard to prove, but isn't it reasonable to assume that a report would have been more diligent or more would have dug deeper had it been done by an attorney who did not have the conflict? I think that has to be OCC's theory, but is that a reason? Why is that not a reasonable assumption?
First, it was not reasonable because any conflict was fully disclosed and waived by the bank. Mm-hmm. Secondly, the standard under FIREA is violation of a regulation or statute. What the OCC is trying to travel on is the Florida Rules of Professional Conduct. Those rules provide specifically that they are not the basis for any enforcement action or any legal actions. Therefore, the OCC would have to have known, had it looked at the rules it claimed it was relying on to create a breach of fiduciary duty, that they could not be used for that purpose. Now, as to the effect prong of the requirement under the IAP, an institutional affiliated party, requirements to have jurisdiction over Mr. Lumier. But it has to show that it has to have more than a minimal effect adversely on the bank. Here, there was absolutely no adverse effect. Mr. Lumier's report was acknowledged by Deloitte and the audit committee as the source of the bank's determination that it had to restate its financials. And that was done immediately after the report being rendered.
Well, I guess one theory is, and this has a chain of assumptions, but one theory is that without the conflict, assume arguendo, there's a conflict, without the conflict, the law firm, your client, would have dug deeper. Had they dug deeper in the report, they would have disclosed information that would have caused the bank to replace the officers, and had the bank replaced the officers, they would not have engaged in further wrongdoing. Now, that's a chain of assumptions, but why aren't those assumptions reasonable enough to at least bring a case?
They're not reasonable because the OCC itself could not come to that determination. The OCC spent 2 years, a total of 11 actual months within the bank, using, in 1999, 15 certified bank examiners, and in 2000, 19 certified bank examiners, poring through the records. They had the access to 10 outside experts within the OCC on all the issues that they had to look at. They also had a team.
I guess your theory is we don't have to guess here what would have happened had there not been a conflict, because we have an example of a thorough investigation to compare it against, namely the OCC's, and they didn't do any better.
Exactly, Your Honor. They could not come to this conclusion, and they had the power under the Bank Administration Act to remove, discipline, or institute cease and desist actions against these three officers. They did nothing, except in their report, they said the principal bad guy had a role, continuing role to play in the bank. And the worst they could say is they didn't strongly support bank management. And if the OCC can't do that in 2.5 years, how could they be substantially justified in saying a team of four lawyers should do it in 2.5 months? That just does not meet the standard of review set forth in Pierce versus Underwood for what is substantial justification. That standard is that you look at what a reasonable person would consider to be a reasonable basis in fact and law to find substantial justification. It couldn't be substantially justified if the OCC couldn't do it in 2.5 years, say that a team of four lawyers should do it in 2.5 months. The OCC likewise did not have jurisdiction over either Mr. Lumiere or the law firm to bring this action under FIREA, because when you look at the legislative history involved, FIREA legislative history, Congress says, Your Honor, I've tried to reserve 2 minutes, but the legislative history says that outside lawyers acting in good faith providing legal advice are not subject to the control under this act. And that's exactly what Mr. Lumiere and Greenberg Traurig were doing. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right. Mr. Jordan.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Douglas Jordan and I represent the OCC. There's only one issue properly before the court. Whether substantial evidence supports the conclusion of the ALJ in the fees proceeding that the position of the OCC was substantially justified in law and in fact. Because such evidence demonstrably exists, and because petitioner cannot negate its existence, the petition should be denied. This is a case where petitioner, Mr. Lumiere, as an outside counsel and thus under the banking statutes an independent contractor to a national bank, took on an engagement to investigate circumstances that strongly suggested fraud by the bank officers, which in fact did exist.
Why didn't OCC find it any faster than the law firm?
The OCC did find it, Your Honor.
Any faster?
Well, we have
in the initial report. I mean, wasn't the whole key to this was the guy who flipped, the insider?
Over time, but as you recall.
Yeah, and Mr. Lumiere never even had access to him, right?
I don't think it was the guy who flipped. It was the counterparties.
Right, but the witness, I'm sorry, an insider, essentially.
Of the counterparties.
Of the counterparties, who was the key witness. Maybe flipped is not the right term. But the insider witness, and Mr. Lumiere was never permitted to talk to him.
Well, we didn't control that. He tried to talk to
but
him.
But that's a fact,
what
correct?
What Mr. Rumier did
have. Is that
have,
a fact or not?
That we controlled the counterparty?
No, that he was not permitted to talk to him.
What he
you
says is that he asked to talk to him and was denied.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any reason to doubt that?
We don't.
Okay. And without talking to him, it's very difficult to conclude that the bank officers were intentionally doing the wrongdoing, right? Because that was the key to your case.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree.
Okay.
The comptroller found that in Mr. Lumier's report, it was undeniable that these were adjusted price trades. Mm-hmm. There was a quid pro quo. We will do this trade, you do that trade. They made no financial sense other than as adjusted price trades. As a consequence, as he says, as soon as the report was given to the audit committee, they and Deloitte, they restated the financials.
Right, so the report disclosed some reason to be concerned.
Yes, it did.
And then the question really goes to state of mind of the officers, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is notoriously difficult to get behind without a smoking gun email or an insider.
Or, as the controller said, here the conclusions departed strikingly from the evidence. Mr. Lumier took the face value that they always engaged in trades at par value.
That's the kind of argument, these facts are so obvious that the people participating must have intended the wrongdoing. But that's a tough thing to conclude unless you have, at least to prove, unless you have a witness. And you eventually got the witness. Mr. Lumier was not permitted access to the witness.
The controller thought that you could reach that conclusion based upon the evidence in the reports. These were clearly adjusted price trades. Plainly, they're adjusted price trades. You don't do that unintentionally. Moreover, they said, oh, we always trade at par value. The records of the bank showed they didn't trade at par value. They traded market value.
That was disclosed in the report, right?
Not the latter. He said in the report, they told me they traded at, he didn't look into the records in order to determine that this was untrue. But in the report itself, there was ample evidence that what they were saying was untrue. He goes up to the line and says, here are these simultaneous transactions, buy, sell, that only make sense as adjusted price trades.
So you have to, it seems to me, and I was doing this with the opposing counsel, you have to show on the effects prong, which to me at least seems the key for this appeal, you have to show that the report would have been different. Had the report been different, the board would have changed out the officers, and had the new officers been in place, they would have not engaged in some of the after-the-fact, let's call it, wrongdoing. I think the last one you can prove pretty easily. On the first one we've been discussing, what about the fact that the bank director says that we would have required a second opinion?
Your Honor, first of all, that was not in this record. That was in a attachment to a pleading in the reply. So just technically, okay. Not properly before the court. But let's assume it was. If Mr. Lumia's report had said these people are lying and they want to get a second opinion, more likely than the second opinion would say, well, if they're lying, perhaps we should change out bank management. Getting a second opinion does not sever the potential alternative chain of events. But you're quite right that the substantial evidence of effects here.
You think the first report should have said these guys are lying?
Yes. Or else I can't reach a conclusion. What he said is there is no evidence that they are lying, even though the comptroller said that conclusion departs strikingly from the plain evidence before him that he reported. The comptroller's decision has a quote from the quid pro quo. We'll do this swap in return for this swap. It made no economic sense other than what it in fact was an adjusted price trade. Deloitte had been consulted by the bank. What's the accounting treatment for these kinds of things? They say, well, if you do this, you have to report that they're linked. They deny that they were linked. It makes no sense other than that. And that's the reason as soon as the report, I'm sorry, Judge Brown?
I'm just trying to follow the chain of reasoning here. I mean, it seems like a long chain of speculation. First, that if he had said something different in the report, the board might have done something different in terms of management. So they may not have been there. But even if we get that far, what was the, you know, what was the additional wrongdoing?
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me first reinforce the first level of causation. Deloitte was all over this. They had ceased conducting audit services in August, one assumes because of potential liability. They wanted a report before they resumed audit services. Now, this has consequences in the marketplace, securities, and so forth. So Deloitte was monitoring this very closely. In December 5th of 2000, there was a Deloitte memo to the file that said that based upon the Lumi report, the audit committee concluded there was not enough evidence to terminate the chief financial officer for cause. He had a contract. And so they said, well, we'll have to buy him out. They limited his duties, but they couldn't terminate him. And then later, May 25th, 2001, Deloitte does a memo to the file saying, we talked to the audit committee based upon the Greenberg report, we can't conclude that these people engaged in wrongdoing. So there are no, Greenberg did not recommend any other remedial actions. So therefore, there's nothing else we can do. So Deloitte says we will, on that basis, resume audit services. As to the harm to the bank of having dishonest officers, first, it's sort of a fundamental principle of bank supervision that dishonest officers can hurt the bank any number of ways.
Well, they can, but we're talking about criminal liability here, and to show that he's an IAP, you have to meet this effects test, right, which shows harm or could have harm
or likely, more than minimal loss to the bank or significant adverse effects. Significant adverse effects is in the statute and was in the notice of charges. That sort of fell out during the litigation. But we had substantial evidence. We had testimony of a bank examiner about the effects of having dishonest management. Among the things that in a bank you're concerned about is reputation risk. So if you have people who are suspected of dishonesty, in fact turned out to go to jail for fraud, that can have bad effects on the bank. The bank was closed months after these operative effects.
Well, obviously, I mean, this bank was in trouble.
It was in trouble going in. We can't.
Everything played out as you would expect it would. But what I'm trying to get at is you had two different, you had an ALJ look at this and said the effects, you know, prong of this not met. You had the OCC look at it and say, you know, the effects not met. So what we're looking at is whether the comptroller was substantially justified, right, in bringing this action.
Yes.
And when you have both of them saying, you know, we don't see this effect.
Your Honor, first, the recommended decision has no weight.
I understand they rejected it.
The comptroller rejected it.
But on this issue,
the
final decision says the same.
The comptroller said, the comptroller wanted more specificity. And first of all, this is a writing on a blank slate. There's not a whole lot of case law on this. So the enforcement people at the OCC are not going against any kind of defined test. And moreover, the comptroller did not purport to apply a defined test.
Well, what about although I don't usually rely on this either, but there is some legislative history that suggests that when they're looking at outside counsel, they weren't intending to catch them in this web unless there was some level of complicity.
No, Your Honor. The culpability is the prong, and as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out, recklessness is sufficient to give the OCC authority over an independent contractor, be it an accountant or a lawyer. So it doesn't mean complicity, it's recklessness.
Well, what I'm saying is the way I read this language about how you become an institution-affiliated party, they're essentially saying you have to be doing something, you know, within the activity of the bank that leads to this adverse effect.
Your Honor, I think that in the wake of Grant Thornton as to unsafe or unsound banking practice, that might be the conclusion. But here we have a different theory and a different set of elements. Breach of fiduciary duty engaged in recklessly. Recklessly means acting in disregard of known or obvious facts. Here, not only did Mr. Lumi reach a conclusion in November, later on, the OCC and Deloitte said, hey, wait a second, are you ignoring some things here? Go back and have a do-over. And he repeated the same thing. That's reckless. That doesn't mean complicity. And Judge Kavanaugh, our theory does not link the dots there to say the conflict was motivation. We are agnostic as to motivation. There was a conflict. The controller said, yeah, but it wasn't reckless enough because everyone knew about it. But the culpability comes from the recklessness of looking at these facts.
Okay, that's interesting because I thought you had to establish that the conflict problem caused the effects that you're alleging here.
Breach of fiduciary duty, there are three different flavors we talked about here. Mm-hmm. Duty of care, controller found that, sufficient evidence for that. Duty of candor, because Mr. Lumier in his report answered questions other than ones asked of him. As to the conflict, duty of loyalty, the controller found enough evidence to support the existence of a conflict that was not cured, but said since everyone knew about it, there's not enough evidence to show that he was reckless on this sub-prong. But there was as to duty of care and duty of candor.
Now, in the controller's original opinion on effects, it didn't, on this particular point, whether it would have replaced the officers. It just said it was necessary to demonstrate that the bank likely would have removed the officers, and then it goes on. However, there was no testimony from members of the audit committee, members of the board of directors, Deloitte, or an OCC official concerning what remedial steps would have been taken. So that, doesn't that just show that there was a, you haven't met your burden of putting on any evidence to show this theory?
There certainly was evidence. There was a testimony of Examiner Reardon, who talked about different flavors of harm, significant adverse effect. Then there were the circumstances here, where Deloitte is poised to go in different directions depending upon the outcome of this report. Had he reported these people were dishonest, as you pointed out before, is a reasonable inference.
Well, the controller said there was no testimony from Deloitte concerning what remedial steps would have been taken had the reports concluded that the senior officers misrepresented their knowledge about the linked nature of the trades.
The controller wanted more specificity than the record provided. It doesn't mean that there was not evidence of the effects. He wanted a higher threshold.
He says no testimony.
No testimony as to exactly what would have happened.
Mm-hmm. But was there testimony as to this reputational effect? I don't remember seeing that specific claim.
I think
Reardon testified about the, one concern that he had was the actual payment for the investigation, he said,
right.
And they dismissed that, I think rightly. And, the other was, I forget now what.
There were several theories. Examiner Reardon.
But I didn't see reputational risk as one of those arguments.
Not in those terms, but Examiner Reardon talked about all the bad things that can happen with dishonest management. This is an experienced bank examiner. He was the examiner for this bank. When you have dishonest management, he did talk about the effects in potential litigation. There was a litigation pending at this time. He talked about the delay in restating the financials of the holding company. The banks had already been restated. Well, that delay wasn't a long time, but in litigation, that can mean dollars.
Well, it seems to make this statute very broad if simply being able to hypothesize that something could happen is enough to subject you to criminal liability.
Well, it's not criminal liability.
To liability under the statute.
Well, we're here just talking about the thresholds in order to get authority. Now, as it turns out, had we established those thresholds on authority, they also have established the basis for the substantive civil money penalty. But that threshold is high. It's not broad. The hoops we have to jump through. And after all, the controller thought there's plenty of evidence here as to misconduct. Plenty of evidence as to recklessness. And there is evidence as to effect is simply not specific enough to satisfy the controller. Writing on a blank slate, he was not applying any defined test. This was just a sufficiency of the evidence in his eyes.
Is it true that OCC did a report after the Lumier report and didn't say, as you said, the Lumier report should have said, they're all lying?
There was an examination report of an examination, which exists independently of the enforcement investigation that was ongoing. The OCC had taken an action in April of 2000 against the bank, temporary cease and desist. It got a consent order in September of 2000 against the bank. This is all ongoing,
Right, but that report, again, after the Lumiere report, doesn't say they're all lying.
No, it was. Investigation was ongoing.
An internal investigation doesn't have that luxury.
Nor does it have the due process concerns that we have in bringing enforcement action.
Nor does it have subpoena power.
No, but the OCC bent over backwards to help out here, even though it's not our charge to help out independent investigators. The sort of coyness at times.
Why didn't you turn over the deposition transcripts then?
Because it would have compromised our own investigation. You know, if you have independent investigations going all the time.
Oftentimes the government investigators don't want to cooperate with private investigators because they want to pursue their own investigation.
Yes.
That's fine, but I understand that, and that's common sense, but then to come back and blame the private investigator for not doing enough and trying.
We departed from SOP in giving him all the help we did. Because it could have tipped off the people we were investigating as exactly where we're going and compromised our investigation. So yes, it looks awkward, but ordinarily we don't sort of say, "Hey, here are the things to go look for."
I'm fine with that part of it. I'm just it seems like you have to take the bitter with the sweet then, and not come back and say, you didn't have all the resources we did, and we didn't share you the stuff, but we're nonetheless going to blast you and bar you from representation in the future because you didn't do a good enough job.
The controller's theory is he didn't need anything more. He had it in the report he made himself.
But the OCC report itself didn't say that.
The examination report is on a separate track from the investigation. And after we closed the bank a few months after this, that investigation went on. We also brought actions against each of the officers. Glear then went to jail. So the OCC was working all this time. Now, the virtue of an independent investigation is ideally that you can do things quickly. You have the insider resources from the bank. And you're not constrained by having to bring an enforcement action in due process to report what the facts tell you you should report.
Other than saying that they're all lying, were there transactions that were not disclosed in the Lumiere report that should have been disclosed?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor. The adjusted price trades were right there.
Right, and disclosed, and they
yes.
and raised concerns. So the report uncovered the facts of the.
Yes, it. Well, and yes. Then we gave him the facts, and he reported those.
And then you draw inferences about state of mind, and that's hard to do unless you have. Sometimes it's so obvious, but.
The controller said the conclusions departed strikingly from the facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other questions?
All right. Thank you,
Your Honor.
How about Mr. Greer? All right. Why don't you take two?
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, what the OCC done has tried to do here is control the conclusions reached by a private lawyer in a private investigation. When the comptroller and the OCC were not the clients. When the lawyers did not reach the conclusions that the OCC wanted, they punished them, even though the OCC has now admitted they couldn't reach those conclusions during its investigation. The bank was closed, it was turned over to the U.S. attorney. The U.S. attorney took 2 years investigating this case further before the malefactors were indicted and prosecuted. This thing was so well hidden that it took the OCC, the U.S. attorney, and all the governmental criminal investigatory powers a total of 4 years to figure it out. They want to punish Mr. Lumiere for not having done it in 2.5 months. The OCC did not cooperate with the investigation. Deloitte, Greenberg, Traurig, Lumiere, and the audit committee all asked the OCC, what else should we look at? What indicates that these people were lying? They said affirmatively nothing. They didn't keep silent. They responded to their question, there's nothing else you should look at. When Mr. Tweedley's statement was brought forward after the fact, they simply read certain snippets out of it. And when Mr. Lumiere and Greenberg-Traurig said, can we read it to see the context of the whole thing? They said no. Any lawyer worth his salt is not going to accept something that's taken out of context and make value judgments as to whether somebody lied or didn't lie without reading the whole thing. That they were operating under, and the report said, this report is based on a preponderance of evidence standard. That was the legal standard they were working on in making the report, and said, under a preponderance of evidence, we cannot determine that these officers lie. They said, we were very troubled by what they did, but we can't make that conclusion given the evidence we had. The OCC has the burden of proof to show that they were substantially justified in doing what they've done. They did not meet that burden.
All right, thank you.